Some of the views expressed on the Mormon Channel are solely for the education and inspiration of our audience and may not represent the official position of the church.
We welcome you again to the Mormon Channel of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and our program, Past Impressions, where we look at the people, places, events, and key issues associated with the history of the Restoration. I'm Brent Topp, the chair of the Department of Church History and Doctrine at Brigham Young University, and I am your host, and we are honored today to have with us again on this program Brother Robin Jensen, a project archivist in the Joseph Smith Papers Project in the LDS Church History Department here in Salt Lake City. Robin is one of our best scholars in schismatic movements of the church, of those that we would that have broken off from the church and had their other Mormon traditions elsewhere. And so Robin has written a great deal on this subject, and it's very, very fascinating. And so we want to continue our discussion today of what happens in the leadership of the church after the death of the prophet Joseph Smith in 1844. So welcome again, Robin, to Past Impressions.
Thank you for having me.
We finished up last time talking about the August 8th meeting and Brigham Young getting the sustaining vote of the saints to press forward with the Quorum of the Twelve, with President Brigham Young as the presiding officer of that quorum as the leadership of the church. We mentioned last time that Sidney Rigdon withdrew his name as being the guardian of the church. And so if we were just to end the story at that point, it would just sound like they roll out of Nauvoo 2 years later, happily ever after, and that there's no problems. But why don't you tell us?
A little bit more complex than that.
Yeah, it's a little more complex than that, and there was more involved in this whole idea of who was going to be the leader of the church than just August 8th, 1844, in the grove by the Nauvoo Temple. Why don't you pick up with that story and tell us how the waters get even muddier?
Sure. Sidney Rigdon withdrew his name on the August 8th meeting, but clearly he was not satisfied with the results of that meeting. Sidney Rigdon was so forceful in claiming his own right as the leader that a month later, in September of 1844, the Quorum of the Twelve met with the church and excommunicated him. He claimed to receive revelation. He claimed to receive or to practice authority over the church that the Twelve said he did not. So he was excommunicated. He left and went to Pennsylvania in Pittsburgh, where he formed his own church, published a newspaper, The Messenger and Advocate, and gathered quite a large following. Now, what we have to realize is that so many of these early claimants talked about polygamy and talked about temple ordinances. Sidney Rigdon claimed that Brigham Young introduced this the practice of plural marriage, and that it was an abomination. And truth is, Joseph Smith introduced this concept, and that Brigham Young was following that practice. But it was a very carefully revealed practice, and so many individuals of the church outside of Nauvoo did not know about this practice. And so when Sidney Rigdon began claiming that Brigham Young was practicing plural marriage, it shocked many people, and they made the choice to leave Brigham Young and follow Sidney Rigdon for that reason. And that really did become a large factor in many individuals leaving Brigham Young to follow someone else. So Sidney Rigdon was there in Pennsylvania, but that quickly fell apart. His church by 1847 had fallen apart. There was claims that Sidney Rigdon was practicing plural marriage, and for the remainder of Rigdon's life, he had a few people talk to him. There were several churches later that organized around his authority, but he essentially became this man who wrote letters and talked about religion in those letters, but didn't have much of an influence after really 1846.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting, especially considering the influence that Rigdon had had from those earliest years.
Yeah.
So,
yep.
Well, in addition to Rigdon and that branch, who are some of the other interesting players in this schismatic movement?
We talked last time about the August 8th, 1844 meeting and how that was published in the Times and Seasons. In that very same issue, there was a small notice in the columns of the newspaper. And I'll just read a little bit of it. It says, "To the saints, whereas elders James J. Strang and Aaron Smith have been circulating a revelation purported to have been received by Joseph Smith, they are therefore cut off from the church."
Interesting.
Now, I would bet that most readers of the Times and Seasons had no idea who James Strang was. Mm. But within 2 or 3 years, he had thousands of saints following him. The story of James Strang is this fascinating story of how one relatively unknown individual could capitalize, maybe that's not the right word, but could fill in a void left by Joseph Smith. So James Strang, he was about 10 years younger than Joseph Smith, was born and raised in New York, similar to Joseph Smith. He moved out west to Wisconsin, and in February of 1844, after hearing much about the Mormons, traveled to Nauvoo and was baptized. So just months before mm-hmm. Joseph Smith's death, he was first introduced to and baptized into the church. He was appointed, as he said, to go find a gathering place for the saints up in Wisconsin.
Because of what is going on in Nauvoo and yep. the Hancock County conflict.
Exactly.
That's going on.
This is not unusual. There were several other individuals appointed to go out west, down to Texas, other places to scout out areas mm-hmm. of possible settlements. So Strang went up to Wisconsin. And then according to his story that he told individuals, he received he had a vision essentially where an angel told him that he would become this great leader and that Voree, the place where he was living, would become this wonderful settlement. Well, later, again, as he claimed, he said he received a letter from Joseph Smith. And this became a critical element in the story of James Strang. It was called the Letter of Appointment. This letter appointed James Strang to be the leader because Joseph Smith was about to die, as the letter said. This was dated just a few weeks before Joseph Smith's death. And this letter of appointment ushered in this new church that James Strang organized.
Interesting. Let's continue talking about James Strang and kind of the history of what we call the Strangites.
So as I mentioned last time, he received this letter from Joseph appointing him to be the successor. He followed that up with several other revelations or several other accounts of visions. And then in 1845, he took several individuals to a hill where they dug underneath a tree and uncovered some plates, ancient plates, where and Strang translated these plates, which the contents claimed Strang would be a leader, a powerful leader. So as you're hearing this, you're thinking of so many things that Joseph Smith did in early times. And so this was very powerful to members of the church who already believed in the Book of Mormon, believed in the revelations of Joseph Smith, believed in the visions of Joseph Smith. There was this other leader that practiced similar spiritual traits of Joseph Smith. So he quickly gained quite a following. Like Sidney Rigdon, James Strang accused Brigham Young of introducing polygamy and claimed that that was an abomination. Mm-hmm. And many individuals followed him. And I think what's important to remember is that the church, only a fraction of the church was living in Nauvoo. There were a lot of church members living in various states in the United States and in England. We had a large presence throughout the United States and into Europe. And so James Strang was able to draw upon these individuals outside of Nauvoo who hadn't quite been as close to Joseph Smith and watching the developments of the doctrine. So James Strang was able to gather this large following based on anti-Brigham Young rhetoric and pro-Joseph Smith events, actions, kind of mimicking Joseph Smith. Well, on a missionary tour in 1847, he took his first plural wife with him and disguised her as his clerk. So what we have is James Strang publicly denouncing polygamy but privately practicing polygamy. Mm. When that became known to the Strangites, the members that followed Strang, it essentially – It really did. There was a lot of individuals who just would not follow James Strang. There were other elements as well, but that was a defining moment in Strang's life. And he had called up to this point the gathering place in Voree, Wisconsin. By the late 1840s, he had changed that to Beaver Island in Lake Michigan. This was a small island. Strang was able to move up there, and he called all the settlers, all of his followers, to Beaver Island. Some historians say that as many as 2,000 followers went to Beaver Island, and he was able to be left alone. Essentially, it was kind of like Utah, where it was somewhat isolated. He had been persecuted as well. And the persecution grew. Beaver Island was this place, a way station for steamboats trying to get wood on Lake Michigan. There were a lot of fishermen. So there was a lot of rough crowds, non-Mormons, not affiliated with any branch of the Mormons, that didn't like the Strangites, the followers of James Strang, moving into Beaver Island.
That probably didn't help matters when he proclaims himself king.
Beaver Island. Yes. In a democracy, a very proud democracy, James Strang had himself crowned the king of Beaver Island. this was probably not so much a political move as a spiritual move.
Right.
But the individuals who, you know, several generations before had overthrown their king in the Revolutionary War, this was not a popular move in antebellum Jacksonian America. So James Strang, king of Beaver Island, reigned with a fairly tight control. He practiced polygamy. Those that followed him knew that and practiced polygamy. He practiced certain ordinances, baptism for the dead, other things that he got from Joseph Smith. But there were several individuals who didn't like this tight control. There was one disgruntled member who eventually was fed up with it and shot James Strang. And as Strang lay dying for a week after his assassination attempt, he refused to appoint any successor, and so he died, leaving his following without a successor. And so this shadowing of Joseph Smith's life went clear until his death, shot by an individual and leaving the church in confusion as to who should be the successor. So from the height in 1846 and 1847 of several thousand individuals, there are now less than 100 official members of this church.
Interesting story. Today on Past Impressions, we're speaking with Robin Jensen about some of the groups and individuals who led groups away from the church after the death of the prophet Joseph Smith. We talked in the last segment about James J. Strang. Earlier, we had talked about Rigdon's claim, but those weren't the only two. Robin, why don't you tell us about some of the other claims to leadership of the church that took Latter-day Saints away from the body of the church in Nauvoo?
And, you know, unfortunately, we don't have time to talk about everyone. There were literally dozens of individuals who claimed some sort of authority over the church, claimed authority either from Joseph Smith or from some outside authority, with the common element of either belief in the Book of Mormon or belief in early Joseph Smith's revelations or what have you. the unfortunate or interesting element of the history of the church is there's continuing detraction and break away from that church, and that's continued all the way up to this day. But there are some individuals who are surprising individuals. John C. Bennett in 1842 was excommunicated from the church, and it was a very public display where he wrote a book, an anti-Mormon book, expose. He later joined the Strangite Church and became a leader in the Strangite Church. And so you have anyone from John C. Bennett to William Marks, who was very devoted to Joseph Smith, but couldn't seem to find his place in Mormonism as he saw it. So,
and William Marks, we'd mentioned before, was probably not keen on the Brigham Young leadership, and he was the one that had been supported by Emma to have a claim to leadership and president of the Nauvoo stake and the High Council there. So,
and you have individuals such as William McClellan, and original members of the 12, founded a church. And not based on his own authority, but based on the authority of David Whitmer. And what's interesting about that is that McClellan had to convince Whitmer of this authority. So there's an interesting interplay there where someone's trying to force an individual to accept authority. So you have these early members that had some influence in Mormonism, which makes sense. There was an attempt to get Oliver Cowdery back into Mormonism before he was ready to give his support of one individual or another. You have individuals such as Martin Harris, who remained in Kirtland, Ohio after the Saints left Nauvoo. He was involved in several organizations. He joined Strangism. He started his own organization with several individuals. And then supported an individual by the name of Gladden Bishop, who was similar to Strang, kind of an unknown individual. But in introducing himself, he introduced ancient writings and revelations that convinced some people to follow him. And so you have this to me, as I look back on it as a historian, I see this very confusing time where if someone wanted to make some claim of leadership in the Mormon Church, they could get a following because it was a confusing time. And when you had the main body of the church making a 1,000-mile journey out to who knows where, then there was a real attraction to continue to practice Mormonism, to continue to practice their beliefs, but not have to move and upset your entire life and your entire family. So there was this void made not just by Joseph Smith, but by the leaving of the Saints to Utah that were filled by many, many individuals.
Very, very fascinating. And, you know, you mentioned it, whether it be a spiritual claim with a revelation, a vision, a document of some sort, or a position claim such as Rigdon, Amasa Lyman, member of the 12, taking a group to Texas. So you can see how difficult and confusing that could be for many of the Latter-day Saints. Why don't you tell me a little bit about the Adams brothers? That's a fascinating story as well.
So I'm interested in understanding how this worked on the ground, not just following the leaders, but how the succession crisis influenced and impacted the members of the church. So we have two brothers, Elias and George Adams. It's unknown when they joined the church. During Joseph Smith's lifetime, joined Mormonism, but it's clear that they had both joined Mormonism and they both enjoyed that bond. Elias was living in Illinois, George was in New York. They were not only brothers, but they also shared this religion. And you could tell there's, unfortunately, we don't have many sources, but there are two letters written from Elias to George following the death of Joseph Smith. The first letter, Elias writes to George and talks about the news, talks about the tragedy of Joseph Smith's death, talks about the 12 and how they are accepting leadership, and then just the events going on. And then before the second letter is written, Elias hears word that George joins Strang. And so here you have Elias writing a letter to George, convincing him why he shouldn't be following Strang, but instead following Brigham Young. And I'm going to read the very last sentence, which I think captures the real trial of what was going on. I will close my epistle by saying, I pray my heavenly Father that you will give the subject that consideration its importance demands. For I know that by following James J. Strang, you are following a false prophet, and you cannot get into the celestial glory. Though if you follow him for any length of time, you will find he is on a sandy foundation. But I hope better things, and that you will be prepared to go with us by the time the grass grows. Go with us out to the west, and bring as many with you as you possibly can. I know it will be for your salvation, and by doing so, you will be a savior of men. Mm. So to me, this really captures this heartbreaking sense of here you had this shared belief, and then all of a sudden it's fractured. Mm-hmm. And that really is what happened to the church. It fractured the church.
I think that's especially touching where it is within family. We speak of the Civil War as brother against brother. After the death of the prophet Joseph, there was probably even fragmentation within families as to where to go.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us how this pulled and tore at people and how that ultimately leads people in much different directions than what they originally intended?
I think one example really illustrates what people were experiencing at this time. There was a man by the name of Aaron Smith, no relation to Joseph Smith, but he was an early member. He was a member by the early 1830s. But when if you'll recall, he was listed with James J. Strang as being excommunicated from the church. So he was a very early follower of James Strang, someone who was reaching out for an understanding of what to do after Joseph Smith's death. When James Strang brought John C. Bennett into his leadership, that was a little too much for Aaron Smith. He knew the history of John C. Bennett. And then when he heard about Strang practicing polygamy, that just sealed the deal. He left James J. Strang. But he didn't know exactly what to do, so he founded his own church and published his own newspaper. It was essentially an anti-Strang church, which there's not much foundation there. So that quickly fizzled out. But he then joined McClellan, followed his church, William McClellan, preached for McClellan until that organization kind of dissolved. And then he joined a branch by the name of Zarahemla. It was the Zarahemla branch in the Midwest, and it wasn't really affiliated with anyone. It was just a group of Mormons that gathered together and said, we want to practice Mormonism, but we don't necessarily have any one leader. And this branch is interesting because it's one of the branches that provides the early beginnings of what we know of as the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. What happened is there were many, many individuals like Aaron Smith. He was searching, and he could not find what he wanted. He had this understanding of what it meant to be a Mormon, what it meant to be a follower of Joseph Smith in the Book of Mormon, but he couldn't find an organization to match that. So he was a wanderer. He went from one organization to another. And as I said, there were hundreds and thousands of these individuals. And by the 1850s, you had a group of individuals who wanted to bring all of these individuals together, but they didn't know how to do it until they looked to the Smith family, and they saw that Joseph Smith III was a perfect candidate as a son of Joseph Smith, as part of the Smith family. They knew that Joseph Smith III would be a perfect leader. So they approached Joseph Smith III and said, will you take on this responsibility? Will you be the leader? And Joseph Smith III said, no. Mm-hmm. And then they came back, and that took them a few times, and finally he agreed. And so on April 6th, which was a purposeful date, the founding of the church, April 6th, 1860, they met in Illinois. And they ordained Joseph Smith III, several individuals, including William Marks, ordained Joseph Smith III to be the president of the church. And that church wasn't officially called the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints until 1872, but it became a powerful movement in the Midwest in that it was able to collect all of these saints who had been lost. Mm-hmm. And that church is known as today as the Community of Christ. So we, which has many members and is an important church in its own right. And we share this common heritage and we share many similarities in doctrine and beliefs. And as I look at these, this church, particularly the Community of Christ, I see a cousin. Uh-huh. A cousin organization. I think we've had a history in the past of degrading the RLDS Church and those that joined, including Emma Smith, which I think is unfortunate. I think they, as I said earlier, attests to the power and influence and inspiration of Mormonism, of the Book of Mormon, of Joseph Smith, of the Doctrine and Covenants. To them, it was a different way of expressing that belief.
Yeah, very, very interesting. And it is, of course, the largest and the most familiar of any of the other groups to us as members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Well, Robin, as we come to the end of this program, you have studied this probably more than just about anybody else in the church. What's your takeaway? What is it that you have gained, not just the sheer curiosity as a historian? What is it spiritually, emotionally, intellectually that you have gained as you have studied these various traditions and studied in the succession crisis? What is it that you know the most from that?
You know, there's a few things that I take away from it. Looking at it not as a historian, I think there's a lot of things we could talk about it from a historian's perspective. But you know, in the church and as Christians, we're counseled to be generous, to be Christ-like to those that we look at. And as a historian, I take the same approach with historical figures and historical sources. So I like to be as generous as I can when I look at these individuals. They're doing the very best they can. They are trying to show their expression of faith. And as I said earlier, it's a way in which we can be unified in this belief of Mormonism, of the Book of Mormon, of the church. And as I look at these individuals in the past, I realize that my own journey in the gospel is similar. I wander from the path occasionally. I sometimes am lost. I sometimes don't know where I need to go. And so when I look at these individuals who were also lost, I realize, you know, as long as I stick to the core beliefs, as long as I stick to a testimony of the Book of Mormon is of Joseph Smith and the current prophet, there will always be that beacon wherein I can find comfort for my life.
That's well stated. Thank you so much for being our guest on Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saint. I'm Brent Topp, your host, inviting you to listen to some of our past episodes, but also look forward to having you join us as we have other scholars, historians, and interesting guests talking to us about the people, places, events, and key issues associated with the history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.